would be a really good time in these crazy COVID times. Thank you for listening, and I hope you've enjoyed the show. Stay tuned for another Different Nature next week. This has been Rich, and I'm going to leave you with some Ernest Hood from the album Neighborhoods.
Listening to KBOO Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your Portland dial, KBOO.FM on your everywhere on earth internet dial. Stay safe, stay sane, stay tuned. KBOO, the best in community radio.
Hey KBOO supporters, this is Cat Meow, KBOO's board president. Due to the COVID-19 crisis, KBOO has had to cancel our annual spring membership drive. Canceling such an important fundraiser was not an easy choice, but thanks to an anonymous donor, every dollar contributed now through May 31st will be matched up to $20,000. We know that times are tough right now, so we're asking those of you who are able to give to donate today at kboo.fm/give. Financial support from our listeners is what allows community radio to carry out the important role we play in times like these. Give today at our website. Again, that's kboo.fm/give. Thanks for your support, and thanks for tuning in.
Hello, you're listening to KBOO FM Portland, KBOO on the air, keeping Portland safe and in touch. This is community radio. And this is Wider Window Poetry, bringing you voices you may not have heard from places you may not have been. I'm your host, Teal Ansari. And it's my honor and my privilege in these times when many of us are feeling a little confined to provide opportunities for your thoughts and imagination to roam freely. And I thank KBOO's tireless volunteers for making it all possible and making it easy for us all to continue to participate remotely. And I ask you, if you at all possibly can, to support KBOO in times like these. We need community and we need communication, and that's what KBOO's all about. I do have a guest this month. Before I introduce her, I'm going to read a couple of poems by Joy Harjo. Joy Harjo should need no introduction to you. She is our current poet laureate and is an internationally renowned performer and poet. She belongs to the Muscogee Nation, and you can find more about Joy Harjo at her website, joyharjo.com. I'm going to read from her most recent book, which is titled Conflict Resolution for Holy Beings. I'm going to start by reading a couple of excerpts from the first poem in the book, which is quite a long poem, and it's titled, For Calling the Spirit Back from Wandering the Earth in Its Human Feet. Put down that bag of potato chips, that white bread, that bottle of pop. Turn off that cell phone, computer, and remote control. Open the door, then close it behind you. Take a breath offered by friendly winds. They travel the earth gathering essences of plants to clean. Give it back with gratitude. And then a little later in the poem, don't worry. The heart knows the way, though there may be high rises, interstates, checkpoints, armed soldiers, massacres, wars, and those who will despise you because they despise themselves. The journey might take you a few hours, a day, a year, a few years, 100, 1,000, or even more. Watch your mind. Without training, it might run away and leave your heart for the immense human feast set by the thieves of time. Do not hold regrets. And that's from For Calling the Spirit Back from Wandering the Earth in Its Human Feet. And I'm also going to read a shorter poem from later in the book, which is titled Praise the Rain. This is good advice for Portlanders. Praise the rain, the seagull dive, the curl of plant, the raven talk. Praise the hurt, the house slack, the stand of trees, the dignity. Praise the dark, the moon cradle, the sky fall, the bear sleep. Praise the mist, the warrior name, the earth eclipse, the fired leap. Praise the backwards upward sky, the baby cry, the spirit food. Praise canoe, the fish rush, the hole for frog, the upside down. Praise the day, the cloud cup, the mind flat, forget it all. Praise crazy, praise sad. Praise the path on which we're led. Praise the roads on earth and water. Praise the eater and the eaten. Praise beginnings, praise the end. Praise the song and praise the singer. Praise the rain, it brings more rain. Praise the rain, it brings more rain. And that was Joy Harjo, our poet laureate. Now I'd like to introduce my guest, Jennifer Perrine. She's the author of three books of poetry, No Confession, No Mass, which won the Publishing Triangle Audre Lorde Award and the Prairie Schooner Book Prize, In the Human Zoo, and The Body is No Machine. And she has a fourth book, again, which is forthcoming from Airlie Press. And Jennifer's recent poetry and fiction have appeared in Rattle, Valparaiso Fiction Review, and a folio titled Bearing Arms, Responding to Guns in the American Culture from Broadsided Press. Jennifer is a recipient of the 2019 Oregon Poetry Community Fellowship from Literary Arts. She works as the Director of Learning and Engagement for College Possible, and she also hosts a poetry show on KBOO, which I'm going to ask her to tell us about a little later on. And you can also visit her at her website, jenniferperrine.org. That's P-E-R-R-I-N-E.org. So with no further ado, I would like to ask Jennifer to read us some poetry.
Sure. Maybe I'll read this poem. This is the one that was mentioned in that introduction when we were talking about the folio on guns in American culture. This poem is called Now Is Not the Time to Talk About Gun Control. After her honeymoon, Katie returns to work. She makes sure to back her truck into the lot so her Oregonian sticker is visible to us all. Keenan, the new hire, asks where to go in the event of an active shooter. These walls are all windows. In the team meeting, Katie does not cry when she tells us how, the night they arrived back in the States, her new husband was stupid just the once, blew away his right knee cleaning a loaded gun. I'm lucky I was home, Katie says. No one asks about the safety, if he checked the chamber after he dropped the magazine. Later at our desks, winter sun glares across our screens, dares us to look outside. Keenan pulls the blinds. At least we would see them coming, he says. He taps the glass, lowers the shade on Katie's tailgate, just married, still soaked on the black paint. And I'll read this one too. I have been writing much more recently now that I'm at home much of the time because of the stay-at-home orders. And this poem, I wrote it on the day of the spring equinox, or maybe the day after. And I had been mostly at home, working from home that week because we'd started to shut down businesses here in Portland. And I did go out for the day to Forest Park, and so wrote this poem after that experience. On the spring equinox, March 19th, 2020. The bulbs my partner planted in fall bloom slivers of blue in those ugly buckets beside the garage door. The dogs nibble their petals, and I swipe the poison from their tongues as I belt them into the car. Absent the afternoon rush, the jagged diagonal that cuts through town takes just 20 minutes. The dogs still pant and whine through the last five. At the park, the paid lot is empty. The archery range is full of men in camouflage. I skirt that field, choose a trail where only a few runners edge past. The dogs strain at their leashes, dash toward the bench where the stoners always sit. Today there's no sign of them, though someone's left a jar of daffodils in their stead. Up ahead, children pick up leaves and ask their mother, "What kind?" The woman shrugs, rubs her hand over rough bark, takes her best guess. At the overlook, I watch the city dressed in light. I hear no planes overhead. Haze hovers in the distance, no mountains in sight. Here, though, it's clear, the sun brighter than it's been in weeks. I tug my short sleeves so I won't burn my new half-inked tattoo of an eclipse, the moon not yet cratered, the dark sky wearing freckled skin where stars should live. I pull the dogs, follow the path lined with saucer magnolias, their leafless branches strewn with buds, pink and purple eggs unhatched. My partner isn't here to name the bird that coughs its strange song from the stand of maples. The dogs whimper, hide behind my legs. All the water I've brought is gone. I circle back to the car, its exhale of overheated air. The dogs sleep as I drive with the windows down all the way to the house, which is just as I left it, save one yellow iris that has unfurled in its ugly bucket on its short stalk, burst open as if it couldn't be stopped.
And were the dogs all right after the almost poisoning?
They were fine. I managed to pull the bulbs out of their mouth before they actually chewed on them.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that. So tell us about your KBOO show.
Yeah, the show, it's called The Occasion. It started 2 months ago, and it airs the fourth Monday of each month. And it's a themed poetry show, so each month there's a different theme around which the poetry is centered. And the guests for that month, I asked them to bring a couple of poems that they've written that are related to that theme in some way, and then to bring in poems by other poets that they appreciate who are also speaking to that theme in some of their poems. And then the challenge or excitement, depending on who the guest is that I also ask people to write a poem specifically for the occasion of the show and have it also be set around that theme in some way. So a couple of people have really enjoyed the process and have just dived into it and feel like it's just one more kind of prompt to use for writing when they get stuck. And some other folks are like, oh my goodness, I don't know if I'm gonna have time to write this new thing, especially now in the midst of lots of other kind of challenging times. So it's a bit of an adventure just seeing how people respond to generating something new and just for the show.
Right. So, I mean, apart from obviously the challenge of the time, what gave you the idea to structure a show that way? I know, you know, some poets are really not in favor of using prompts, find it difficult or find it confining. Other poets really enjoy it a lot.
Yeah, I think when I was thinking about it originally, I was thinking about it less as a prompt and more of as about an opportunity to have something that was about the specificity of a moment or a particular time, that is thinking about maybe recordings, like records, like literal hard records, and how, you know, there was a certain point at which those were recordings of an event of music being played in a particular space for a particular audience, and wanting to capture a little bit of that with the show, the sense that somebody had made something new just for this this space or this time. Part of the way that I structured it did end up having that prompt element about it because it was thematic, but really the goal is just to have folks really consider like what do I want to create for this time or for this space, and how can I make something new out of it.
Okay, well, let's hear some more poetry if you would.
Sure. So this is a poem from the book that's coming out later this year. Actually, maybe I'll read a couple of poems from that. The book is called Again, and it'll be out this fall, hopefully, if all printers and other places are reopening soon. And it's safe to do so. But this is a poem called Mess. Who served us? Who placed the dish, stirred the pap that clung to our lips? Who spilled the wine on the floor? Who called out for more as we chewed the fat, skipped from one thought to the next, slipped our tongues in the mouths of friends? We did not plan for how the meal would end. We jarred teeth loose on bread. We gnashed and gnawed. We mashed fists on flesh to no touch. We could not help but give in to such bets. What lush digs, what land of rose and milk? Who doled out this fare, each course lapped from the bowl we shared? Who was it we once dined with in this hall where we passed the plate licked clean? And this is another poem also from the same book. It's called Dog. Do not let me off my leash. Keep me tethered, my gleaming teeth forever in reach. Now you've tamed me. I'll cram my hackle, play the wag. When you shut the door, I'll whine, left behind, but stow all barks and howls, all bays that may offend. For you, I'll keep my snout clean. For you, I'll end the prowl. You've put my wild to work, given me this pristine bowl of water to lap, a groomer to smooth my fur, to comb out the mats. Still, I can't help notice your scent resembles the musk of the one who once called me mutt, kicked me in the gut, sent me panting. Blood-crusted where my ear was torn by that cur. His voice, so much like yours, hounds my dreams, shouts, mongrel bitch, hunts until I bite, grip tight the bone, shake my head to break the neck. I wake with snarl and slaver, strain against my silver chain. Forgive my poor training, my bad deeds. He was my master, but that is past. You're a different man. Yours is the hand that feeds.
So this book is coming out from Airlie. Hopefully it's not delayed too much. Can you tell us about Airlie Press? I've had guests before from Airlie, and sort of describe the Airlie experience.
Yeah. So it's a shared work press, which means that all of us who are having our books published through the traditional model, so not through through the prize that Airlie runs, we're also serving as editors on the press and doing the all of the work that the press does to make sure that we edit and design and actually get the books out into people's hands. So that means that I wrote this particular book in early 2017 and sent it to the press, and the group of editors who was there at the time read it, and we talked, I guess, at the end of 2018. And I joined the press at the beginning of 2019. So last year, I was really kind of learning the ropes of the press, understanding how it operated, and supporting the publication and marketing of all the books that came out last year. And this year, working with the press to produce my book. And next year, I'll be welcoming some new poets into the collective and working with them to sort of share what I've learned in the last few years. So it's been a really, it's been a real journey, having had books published before where I just sent a manuscript in and then magically a few months later, an object was produced.
Right.
I think this has shown me the amount of labor that goes into to all of that space between manuscript and object. And all of the makes me appreciate all of the work that the different presses that I've worked with have done to, you know, actually make my books accessible and available to readers.
So the poem Mess that you read, you also sent me a written, I put that in quotes because it actually looks like it was typed on a computer.
Yeah.
Copy of that. And obviously, our listeners cannot tell this, but the words are arranged in kind of a grid.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a form to it. It's not an obvious form in listening, but there's definitely a form in reading. Can you talk a little bit about that? What's the intention of it?
Yeah. So that poem is formally and visually really different from all the other poems in the book. All of the poems they're all in written in syllabics. So every each poem, there's a set number of syllables per line. And at the time that I was writing, I did that because I really needed the structure. I was writing all of these poems in one fashion or another in response to the election of Donald Trump and to the ways that he his language corrupted and disrupted the way that I had thought about language. And so was taking words that he used frequently and where I couldn't hear them in any other voice but his anymore, and trying to reestablish them in some context that made more sense to me. And so giving them these tight structures of syllabics helped me to not just spin out into all of the awful thoughts that I had at the time. But this poem in particular, the grid format came about because I was trying to create some tension between that sense of mess and like almost, I guess, overindulgence that the poem is trying to represent. There's the idea of messes and mess halls, so all of these people dining together, but also a lot of the things that are described are the sort of luxuries that can come with the decadence of consumerism and capitalism, and the things that can make available. And all of those things seem very unwieldy and chaotic. And I wanted to see what would happen if I put them into this thing, like almost like a map that is very, very square, very rigid, very hard looking, and to kind of visually create a tone that might not be there in the words themselves.
So this whole book, you would say, is kind of an active reclaiming language, reclaiming vocabulary from the ways that it's currently being misused?
Yeah, that's part of the what emerged in the process of writing it. At the time, I was just taking these words that were felt like they were being misused or even just overused. There's a certain like set of vocabulary that I think Trump returns to repeatedly, and it started partly as a reclamation of that language and to trying to resituate it into ways that I would describe it or ways that I have heard other people use that language. But also it, in the course of writing that, it also kind of became a map of what I was feeling and what the different communities I was part of were feeling during that time when everything seemed very sort of both not surprising in a certain way, but also very disorienting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And has formal structure been important in your poetry before this?
It has. I would say almost all of the poems that I've written for at least the last decade and maybe even longer have been in one form or another, whether it's a nonce form that I've created just for that particular poem or like a received traditional form, like a sonnet or a villanelle. I remember being young, maybe college age or a little bit earlier, and thinking that form was this foolish confining thing that I wanted no part of. And then when I was, I think it was probably when I had just started grad school and I had the chance to take a poetry class with Sonia Sanchez, and she asked all of us in the class to write all of our poems for that semester in a series of different forms. And at the time I still was very resistant, and I think she probably found me kind of obnoxious because in the spirit of anyone who's ever thought they knew more than they really did, I wanted to write all of my free verse poems and just think that, you know, there was no space for form. But through the course of that semester, she just introduced me to so many poets who were writing in these different received forms and doing really, making really progressive arguments through them, or using the voices or perspectives of marginalized people, so that it showed me this tension that could be created where you've got this form that's often very Eurocentric, or that is has been deployed for, like, you know, the sonnets. So many of them were about like this male gaze on a woman's body and taking it apart through the course of the sonnet. And but she introduced me to all these ways of trying to subvert those traditions, and something about that just stuck. And so for years now, I've just returned to different forms over and over because they feel like they're so rich now, and they give me something to kind of bounce off of so that I don't, so that I have to work a little bit harder to get to the, whatever the final version of the poem is. And I feel like it makes the poem better for having done that.
Mm-hmm. Could we maybe hear a few of those?
I'll read this one. This is a poem I wrote very recently, and it's not using any of those sort of received forms in the sense that I was talking about, like a sonnet or a villanelle, but it is using an Ulipo technique called Beautiful Outlaw. So the idea behind this is to exclude a particular letter mm-hmm. from the poem, and And in this one, I've kind of played with it a little bit. So in each stanza, there's one letter that is excluded and all the other letters are present. And the poem is called Sickness. We never married, thought it too quaint, too ball and chain, fixed, pinned. We rejected being yoked like oxen, caged together in that hallowed zoo. And yet we dreamt of a honeymoon. Every place we'd explore were money no object. North and south of the equator, shore to shore, dozens of state parks. For now you go as far as your job at the hospital, despite my qualms for the hazard pay. Home at night, you wear a mask, I wear gloves. This is our latex without sex. This is love in a time when every blush conjures fever, when we quiz each other after each cough. I examine your hands, count as you soap them before we touch. For better or worse, we cozy together to wait for the latest dispatch. I exhaust myself with updates, jerk awake hours later. You've covered me with a quilt from your glory box. I find you gazing out a dark window, watching your ghost in glass vanish at civil dawn. I join you, squint to catch that phantom us wearing a gown, a tux. No father gave you away, no mother arranged my veil, no frenzied crowd jockeyed for the bouquet. The rice unthrown we keep in the cupboard. We keep our extravaganza a private joy. We keep each quiet vow in the mouth to have and hold for richer and poorer, now and in health.
That is definitely a poem for this time.
Yeah, I've found myself trying, maybe not even trying, but just it happens, writing love poems in, or things that are sort of love poems in this moment where I'm trying to think about how things change right now when touching other people seems terrifying and also and so needed and wanted, and so this is one of those, I guess.
Yeah, and you know, one shouldn't presume that just because poems are written in the first person they are autobiographical, but it seems that the speaker in this poem has a partner who's a health worker, and as we know, that does confer a greatly increased degree of risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I write this thinking about all the folks for whom that's true, and also having a partner who's in proximity to that work, who isn't a direct healthcare provider, but works with folks in a hospital, and you know, feel lucky that you know, we both are able to work from home now, but also know that a lot of people can't and are doing lots of other work where it's just important and necessary work, and also kind of really difficult for them and for their families to take on that risk.
Right. So actually, maybe you could talk a little bit about College Possible, because not all of our listeners might be familiar with that program. And how is that carrying on under these conditions?
Yeah, good question. So College Possible is an organization that it's a nonprofit that has locations throughout the US, but there is one in Oregon. And the work that we do is really to support students from low-income backgrounds who are often the first in their family to go to college, but not always. And much of the work that we do is working with them in high schools when they're juniors and seniors to help them prepare for the college application process. So, you know, learning how the ACT works, learning how the financial aid process works, that huge complex beast that it is. And then once those students graduate from high school and enter college, also continuing to coach them until they graduate from college. And that's not in person, it's usually tech connected, where, you know, through phone calls, Skype, Zoom, where we are able to connect with those students and check in to see how they're progressing, if there are things that maybe they need that support with that they're not getting directly through their institution that they're attending. So we have had to really adapt, as pretty much everybody has during this time, to try to figure out how we still support those students when we can't see them in person. And for the coaches who work with college students, that's been easy because most of them were doing that all remotely anyway. Mm-hmm. For the high school students, it's been trickier trying to figure out how to curriculum that we have been delivering, or to adapt it to something that is going to better meet where students are at right now. So we've kind of, for the moment, we're only a few weeks in, but for the moment, we've sort of taken on a blend of that, where we're still, now that most students have both internet access and a computer, we've been able to still continue to lead some online sessions for students so that they're still learning about some of those milestones and how to meet them as they progress towards, you know, either applying to college or figuring out which college they want to attend. And coaches have been really great about just, you know, for students who don't have that kind of access, making phone calls or doing other things to make sure that they're connecting with those students. But we've also had to really think too, like, is that what every student needs right now? And for some of them, they've got more pressing concerns at the moment. So for some students, we've had to really think through whether the support we can provide right now is best to, whether it's best to continue just focusing on the college application process, or whether it's more important for particular students to help them find other kinds of resources that they might need to help out with, you know, if they've got younger siblings who are now at home and they're now responsible for childcare, how do they manage doing some of that while also trying to complete high school?
Right.
You know, just, or, you know, some of those students were, had jobs where they were helping to support their family, and now they may not have access to those. And so trying to connect those students with other community resources just to make sure that they're, you know, able to stay financially stable. So I'm really impressed with just how, you know, everybody at the NES, how to meet students where right now, help them where we can.
Yeah, that's really good to hear, and especially as a public school employee myself, it's really encouraging to hear that work's going forward, and that, you know, we're doing our best to support our students, and we couldn't do it without partners, other nonprofit organizations such as yourself. And so the community partners are huge for us, and we really couldn't do our jobs without all of you. So, getting back to poetry. So let's hear a few more poems, if you would, and then I have a couple of kind of more poetry-oriented questions.
Okay. This poem takes its title from a book by Adrienne Marie Brown.
It's called That the Ones You Grieve May Be Grieving You. Dear mostly forgiven, dear have not heard from in 20 years, dear where have you gone, dear how have you been, dear turns out you live in Florida, dear turns out you're still with him, dear despite the gun he once held to your head, now he changes your bedpan, now he's known you longer than I did, through the seizures and the stroke, through your kidneys gone to shit. Now he's beside you in hospice, and has not told you that you're dying. But you're dying, dear one, who once woke me in the night to ask, do you love me? Will you stay? Where did you think I would have fled? Dear, I cannot call on the phone. Dear, cannot hear your voice through the line. Remind me one last time how you formed me in the hollows of your body, how you imagined me and then made me true, matter and fact. Dear, when you begged me to remain with you forever, I said yes. Yes, it was not an act. And this is the second part of that poem. Dear child, I have only known as a child, never grown. I have stalked you through ether to learn your public face, the one that glows, graces my screen, and cannot be the same one you scrub clean each night, the way I taught you, warm washcloth and plain soap. Dear who I hoped for, dear wanted so much, dear I missed your touch, miss it more now that I'm confined to bed, how you once crawled in, rested your head on my pillow so close I could dream you back into my body. Dear, I'm not sorry I stayed with him, only that you made me choose. I did not know I could lose a child so many times, but each year your birthday is a disappearance, and I am both magician and trick. Dear, name slipped from the tip of my tongue. I cannot recall what doll you fussed over, what book you loved best, but I remember what you felt like, mouth on my breast, as I fed you, kept you.
I can read maybe one more poem here. This is a poem from several years ago. And it's part of like the poem that I read at the very beginning. It's part of a series of poems that I've been writing over a long period of time about gun culture and how it has maybe shown up in the U.S., but also in my life in particular. And this is a poem written in response to the Pulse nightclub shooting and written a year after that happened. We call this an anniversary. As if something were born that night, music, the flint that sparked electric through muscle, through sinuous spine, every nerve alight, pulse that leapt each synapse, thrum that filled gaps, spaces where we fled to be safe, brave-faced in the dark that kept time, that pressed us close as if we needed one another's sweat to survive. We do. The breath of the drum, the hum of bass echoes in our hollows. The beat goes on. We whirl and sway in tune with what we have lost. When the DJ winds down, closes up shop, we turn out pockets, upend purses, shake loose all of our change, feed every last dollar to the jukebox. We keep dancing, no matter what the cost.
What brought you to start writing poetry, Jennifer?
Oh, my goodness. I think every time I try to answer that question, I think something different comes out. But
oh, so good. So if I ask you three or four times,
Yeah. So I don't know if this is the truth with a capital T, but I think one thing that's happened was that I had written a lot as a young person, and I think in particular when I was in high school, I maybe wasn't writing poems exactly, but I was journaling a lot. And I had a teacher in high school who offered up a particular assignment where in response to reading the Scarlet Letter, we could either write like sort of a critical essay about it, or we could write a poem in response to it. And in particular, I think she had asked that we choose a character from the book and write from the perspective of that character. And it was the first time I remember writing a poem where it felt like I had really learned something new in the process of writing it. I wrote from the perspective of Pearl, Hester Prynne's daughter, and there was something about it that, you know, kind of gave me access to the character of the book, which I think was what the teacher wanted. But also it made me learn something about myself and how I thought about myself in a relationship to my mother. And it just, I had this moment of I guess, appreciation that I'd never felt before when I wrote something. And so in the years after that, as I entered college, I kept writing poetry kind of on and off, just because I was after that experience of like appreciation or discovery that happens occasionally when I write poems. And I realized that the more I wrote poetry, the more often that happened, and the more I read poetry, the more often that happened. And so somewhere along the way, it became a habit or a ritual to make sense of things that I can't understand. But I think one of the seeds that planted that was having that teacher who just offered it as an option and just, I think, was throwing it out there, and something stuck, rooted.
So you mentioned Sonia Sanchez, and I wonder if there are any other sort of important mentors that you've had in poetry that have really helped shape your poetry.
Yeah. I would say there have been a lot, and many of them are people that I maybe have never even met in person, but who just by reading their work have mentored me in their own way, just to see possibilities that I hadn't before. But I think of people who have actually been sort of physically present in my life, one poet who really changed my life was Cynthia Hoag. She, both through her poetry and her interests and her critical eye that she has cast on other poets and really drawn out the work that they do, but also because when I was in college, I stopped out when I only had I was maybe two classes short of finishing my degree. And Cynthia taught at a college, it was maybe down the road, like 20, 30 miles away from where I was going to school. And so during this period that I had stopped out, I was still going to poetry readings at Bucknell where Cynthia taught, and would go and show up at the readings and really enjoy the poetry and maybe talk to some of the students or faculty afterwards. And over time, Cynthia and I developed a relationship where she kind of pointed out to me, you know, you really should go back and finish school so that you can go to grad school because you seem to enjoy this. And so she really mentored me through the process of trying to figure out, well, how do I go back to school? How do I, you know, find money now that I no longer have financial aid? How do I enroll in grad school, which was something that I knew very little about? And so She's really the reason why I finished, part of the reason at least why I finished college, why I have a graduate degree, why I went on to study poetry and really learned so much more about it than I ever would have on my own. So I credit her with, with almost everything related to how I continue to do this now to this day.
So it was really, you didn't have a formal academic relationship, right? You weren't enrolled in the college where she was teaching, but it was kind of an intervention on her part.
Exactly. And I ended up going to grad school at Bucknell because of her. And so it ended up having later on an academic relationship. But at the time I was just some, 22-year-old, 23-year-old who was hanging out around the Bucknell Poetry Center a lot, and who, she was willing to kind of nurture and help me see, the possibilities in my own life at a time when I really couldn't see anything beyond continuing to work at the mall for the rest of my life and to write, poems in my notebook and have that be as far as it went. And Cynthia, if you ever hear this, thank you.
So this question might have a different answer now than it normally would, but can you talk, do you have a regular writing routine? Do you write every day? And sort of what is your process from getting from an idea to a finished poem?
Yeah. So I'll talk about right now. I pretty much write in depth once a week. So Fridays, I'm fortunate that pretty recently the job that I do has shifted so that I am able to have Fridays to really just focus on writing. I just get up in the morning and start writing draft after draft. And usually throughout the week, I've been thinking about just kind of jotting down images or lines of things that I might want to write about and kind of just journaling. But Fridays are the day when I just really dig in. And my process really is just, I write a first draft and it's very messy. It's almost always just in prose and just kind of getting all of the language out on the page. And then I spend the day just going back to it over and over and refining it and taking things out and giving it a structure, a shape, or seeing what kind of shape might emerge from it until it feels like it's about as good as I am gonna get it. And so usually that's, I'll start at like 8 in the morning and wrap up around like 8 at night. So it's, for me, it's a really intensive process, but I found it really useful at this time because it wipes away like everything else in the world that's going on. Okay. And I just am writing and that's all that there is. And I think I've needed that kind of focus so that, as part of like a mental health routine for myself right mm-hmm. now. Previously, I would either not write very much and not have much of a routine, or if I did, it would be writing for, I'd write like half an hour a day and then, come back to something later in the week, and it would be very sporadic, and it would take, maybe a month to finish a poem because I would just do it in these tiny little segments. And mm-hmm. yeah, so I appreciate having the chance to have that kind of deep focus right now.
Do you feel like, you said you get your poems almost as good as they can be within that first day usually. Do you go back and revise much after that, or has that not happened?
Sometimes I'll let them sit and come back to them and revise them more. I would say that in the past that's been more frequent, where I'm writing things kind of piecemeal, and so when it gets to a place where I like it, I'll kind of leave it and then come back to it in a couple of weeks and see, is it still quite what I want or do I need to revise it more? But lately I've just, I think because I spend so much time with it on the first go, I have not been, I mean, it's revising, I guess, through the course of the day instead of the course of a month.
right.
Yeah. And maybe I'll come back to these poems later on too and say like, oh, I want to revise these as well. But for now, I think maybe I also am enjoying having the satisfaction of just being able to say something is finished when so many other things right now feel like I have to leave them unfinished.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm calling them done. They might not really be done.
Right.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. So to wrap up, I always like to ask a really random question. What's Ooh. A food you've always wanted to try and why?
Oh my goodness. Oh, here's one. I have always wanted to try durian, which I believe, I know it's a fruit, I believe it is most frequently grown in Japan. And I've tried things made out of it, but I've never tried the fruit itself. And the thing that it is most known for is being disgustingly stinky,
mm-hmm.
But the taste is supposed to be great, despite the, or somehow because of the stinkiness. And so I've always wanted to try it and I have not yet, but maybe one day.
So, but that's a fascinating idea, how something can smell so bad and yet taste so good.
Yeah.
So this has been Wider Window Poetry. My guest is Jennifer Perrine. Thank you very much, Jennifer. And thank you, Kebu, for everything you do. And for all my listeners, please stay safe out there and keep tuning in. Thank you all.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Tuesday, May 5th has been dubbed Giving Tuesday Now, a day to raise awareness and support for struggling nonprofits across the U.S. On Tuesday, May 5th at 9 a.m., KBOO will host a Giving Tuesday special program featuring nonprofit organizers talking about their strife and triumph.